As I mentioned yesterday, it seems like this practice is about finding contentment, happiness, and that was the Buddha's discovery, is an unconditional happiness and contentment. And all the teachings point back towards this, it seems. But the question might arise, is that not a Hinayana kind of practice? Just trying to be happy and content ourselves? Is that not the path of the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas? But my understanding is that the Bodhisattvas who vow to benefit all beings and awaken all beings, bring all beings to complete happiness and contentment, that the primary way of doing that, as Bodhisattvas, is to be content and happy. I think if we're like, well, I'm not very content and happy, but you guys better be. I'm going to help you do it, but I'm going to do it while I'm miserable. I don't think so. And a little clue about how this may be so is that on these Bodhisattva bhumis, the grounds of Bodhisattvas, sometimes we say stages, literally these grounds, maybe each ground is like a vista point in the traditional path, Bodhisattva path to Buddhahood. The first Bodhisattva ground is called the very joyful Pramudita. So that's how Bodhisattvas start, is first they find this contentment and unconditioned, maybe very simple and plain joy. So maybe the practice and realization of the Hinayana path, but also the practice and realization of the Mahayana Bodhisattva path. Because when we're fulfilled and content, then that's when we're actually available to others. When we're fulfilled and content because our nature includes everything with nothing outside it. Therefore, nothing possible to be lacking, then all kinds of difficult situations are possible to bring onto the path because they're not outside of ourself. So we're looking at the Zazen Yojinki guidelines for Zazen, or how to use the mind in Zazen. And our ancestor Keizan continues, this has always already been so, but it's still without a name. The third ancestor of Zen in China temporarily called it mind, and Venerable Nagarjuna once called it body. So these are, of course, referencing particular teachings. Do you know what the third ancestor temporarily calling it mind is referring to? Yes. And Xin is mind. It's the trusting mind song. Yeah, by the third ancestor, which is all about, we could say, trusting mind, or the mind that trusts to the truth. So this is a song about mind. And so third ancestor temporarily called it that, and Nagarjuna once called it body. This is a more unusual story. Anyone know this one? You might know it when you hear it, but it's not like we chant it all the time. Anyway, just first of all, I think it's interesting that earlier, a couple paragraphs back, Keizan said, it cannot be called body, it cannot be called mind. And now he's saying, third ancestor temporarily, provisionally, did call it mind, and Nagarjuna one time did call it body. And so, this story, that Dogen quotes in his Buddha Nature essay, is about Nagarjuna. One time when he was sitting, he manifested a body of perfect freedom. It was like the round full moon. Not a person in the assembly saw Nagarjuna's form. They heard only the sound of Dharma. Among them was Kanadeva, or Kanadaiva, Dayosho. And he asked the assembly, can you discern his form? And all those present said, actually, our eyes see nothing, our ears hear nothing, our minds discern nothing, our bodies experience nothing. And Kanadeva said, that itself is the form of Venerable Nagarjuna manifesting Buddha nature. He's doing it to teach us. How do I know this? Because the form of formless samadhi is like the full moon. The meaning of Buddha nature is absolutely empty, clear, and distinct. And when Kanadeva finished speaking, the round moon shape disappeared, and the gardener was sitting on his seat just as before. And he recited a verse saying, body manifesting a round moon shape, expressing thereby the body of the Buddhas, teaching Dharma without any form, teaching without sight or sound. So that's the story, that Nagarjuna manifested his body as a round moon shape. So that's what Keizan's referring to as Nagarjuna once called this, he called it body, this body of round moon shape. And Dogen goes on for pages about this story in his treatise on Buddha nature. He talks about his visit to the temple next door to where he was practicing in China, where they had paintings of all the Zen ancestors that we chant, paintings on the wall. And they all, like, you know, had the regular bodies sitting on seats, except when they got to Nagarjuna, the 14th Indian ancestor, the painting of him was just a round moon. And Dogen talks about his, he was a, you know, young, very inspired monk in China, kind of testing everyone he came across for their Dharma understanding. And so the people who were giving him a tour of this temple, he said, "What's that picture about?" And they said, "Oh, that's Nagarjuna manifesting the full moon body," referring to this ancient story. And Dogen kind of pressed them on the issue, but nobody could really explain it or give their understanding, and he went away disappointed. So this is what part of what Dogen says. "Ignorant people think Nagarjuna is temporarily manifesting a transformation body. That's what he meant by a round moon shape. But that's just an illusory notion held by those who have not realized authentic transmission of the Buddha way. Where and when could you manifest another body, not your own? You should know without any doubt that at the very time Nagarjuna was just sitting there on the seat, the form in which he manifested his body was no different from the form any one of us sitting here right now is manifesting. Right now, our own bodies are manifesting a round moon shape. So it doesn't look different than those other ancestors. It doesn't look like a round white circle. These bodies sitting here and Nagarjuna's human body was itself manifesting the round moon. The manifesting body, Dogen says, is not square or round. It's not existing or non-existing. It's not revealed or concealed. It's not a whole bunch of different conditioned phenomena. It's just a body manifesting itself. So that's a kind of background story. Kazan says, the third ancestor, temporarily called it mind, and Venerable Nagarjuna once called it body. Buddha nature's form was manifest, expressing the essence of all Buddhas, with nothing lacking and nothing extra. This is symbolized by the full moon, but it is this mind which is Buddha itself. It's symbolized by a full moon. The luminosity of the self shines throughout the past and brightens as the present. Nagarjuna used this subtle symbol of the moon for the samadhi of all Buddhas. But this mind is signless, non-dual, and differences between forms are only apparent. Just mind, just body, difference and sameness miss the point. Mind transforms itself and becomes body. When the body arises, then they appear to be distinguished. And when I looked at Shohaku Okamura's few comments about this Zazen Yojinki, he picked up on that line and he said, this is kind of unusual what Keizan is saying here. Maybe it doesn't sound that unusual, but Dogen never talks this way so explicitly to say that mind transforms itself and becomes body. He thought that was a strong statement that he thought unusual statement. Maybe we talk about this thing, this kind of thing around here enough that it doesn't sound that strange, but mind transforms itself and becomes body, and then when the body arises from the mind, they appear to be distinguished. This is the body and this is the mind. But another translation of this phrase is, body arises in mind. Instead of it's literally the Chinese says, body transforms itself and mind transforms itself and becomes body. But this is a nice, another angle on it. The body arises in the mind. And then when the body arises in the mind, they appear to be distinguished. So this is a nice meditation that we can explore in Sesshin about what is this so-called body. It seems that mainly our experience of the body is physical sensation, pleasant or unpleasant sensations, or we might say sensations that we could also label as contracted or relaxed, like a tension and relaxation. I think almost every bodily experience, physical bodily experience, I mean, we can also look at the body, usually when we're sitting zazen, we're having a very vivid experience of the body as physical sensation. Yeah. And it seems to me that all these sensations are quite different, but we could categorize them as either like contracted or like tension or relaxation. Doesn't it seem? Like a sharp pinch is a kind of, in a way, I would say a sort of contracted feeling. There's some tension there. And when it's just like, like an out-breath and maybe in the belly for a moment at the end of the out-breath, it's like a total relaxation, sensation. Almost like relaxation is just the absence of tension. So these are like just things we can explore, and when we say this is really painful or this is pleasant, I think there could also be pleasant sensations that have a kind of tension in them too. But anyway, this is all just way of talking about the body as we experience it, is these sensations. And sensations appear in the mind, right? Therefore, the body is in our direct experience, the body is the knowing of these sensations, the experiencing of contraction and relaxation, of pleasant and unpleasant, the experiencing of these sensations. We could call that the body, but usually if we say experiencing sensations, it's not really that the body is experiencing them, right? It's the mind is the experiencing of the body. The body is a kind of experience of the mind. Isn't it so? Like, but you know, putting aside conceptual ideas about the body is this big chunk of stuff here. That's not our experience, right? That's a conceptual idea. And if we look at it or look at a picture of it or look at another person's body, it looks like a chunk of stuff. But that's not our experience, right? Experience is this actually ungraspable, constantly changing flow of experience. therefore, I think it seems accurate to me to say that body arises in the mind. Yes.
I'm hearing like a value tension between almost negating the body as something that matters because it's only experienced in mind.
Why would that not matter?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, maybe not matters.
Not as important?
Yeah, or something that...
I would almost say like a... I think I see what you're saying is that maybe we could say mind is more primary than the body, and that in this way of talking, mind kind of comes first as primary, because without mind, there's no body that we can look at a corpse, right, and say that's a body, but it's not really. That's our, again, an idea. That's a lump of stuff, inert stuff. But experientially, the only body we'll ever know is the one that's happening in the mind. So I don't think it, to me, it doesn't devalue the experience of the body. In fact, it's the almost like maybe one of our most dominant experiences of mind is called body. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a nice shift of perspective because from this perspective, we see how workable it is. We see how it's the field of sensation that is infinitely flexible and in a way malleable and not inherently dissatisfying.
Where does the partaking in the Buddha body relate to this?
Yeah, well, often when they say Buddha body, it's often referring to like Dharmakaya, which is I think we could say all three bodies of Buddha. Dharmakaya is really almost like, it's called the Dharma body, but from the way we think of the body, it's almost like a disembodied, it's the formless, formless body, right? And then the transformation body of Buddha, the Nirmanakaya, is another version of actually saying it's a manifestation of the Dharmakaya. So you, in that model also, you could say the Nirmanakaya, appears in the Dharmakaya, or maybe even like the literal phrase of Kazon, the Dharmakaya mind transforms itself and becomes a transformation body called Nirmanakaya, which was like Shakyamuni Buddha, who that people could look at and see what looked like a human form. So I think our practice is, when we get more and more deeply into it, exploring these different ways of looking at body, I think is very interesting, because we just assume, I think in our Western culture, we put body as primary because I would say like our Western culture is almost like scientific materialism. We've almost lost our, roots of spirituality and religion and mysticism, yeah. And so scientific materialism, going back how far, is based on like science, and science is all, usually outer science is studying the physical world. So we can study the physical elements of the body and the organs and so on. And I think where it really becomes, where it really shifts out of the spiritual view, is we say that body becomes so primary that mind is derivative of body. That's where it gets really reversed. And I think that's the dominant view in our culture. It's like brain science, right? that mind is produced by a physical brain, and when the body dies, that's the end. That's materialist view. And sometimes we say, well, we don't need to really, you know, we can still fully practice the Buddha way with that view. But the more I think about it, the more I feel like, actually, there's a whole bunch of problems with Buddha Dharma if we really hold that view. Basically, even in terms of being completely free, for example, free from birth and death, with that materialist view, it's impossible then to realize the deathless, and be completely free from birth and death, because I then am totally bound by this body, and when I die, that's it. And I think we could say, maybe in modern Zen, we say, that's fine, I'm just trying to like find contentment in this body right now. But I think from the larger Buddhist tradition, it really unravels the whole tradition in a way to look at that, because Buddha's nirvana was the deathless. And he realized that he didn't die and wasn't born. So it's, in a way, I think it's a huge topic. But it's, you know, from a practical thing about, you know, if we're just giving Zazen instruction on a Saturday morning, we don't need to get into this kind of stuff. Yes.
On a practical level, it's feeling more intimate, pretty interesting, and to watch how the body arises in the mind. Feels calmer to me than I think, because I without words I can actually feel that, but it feels more intimate than trying to navigate the realm of pure thought, or like, where does thought come from? What texture or feeling? What is thought?
Yeah.
But somehow when
yes.
Still, there's not a lot of language, but there's more familiarity or intimacy.
Yes.
So it's
yeah.
More grounding.
That's a great point. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's very present, and it's simpler. These sensations are much simpler than complex conceptual thought and how to work with that. So mindfulness of body, and really being with these sensations and really, like, you know, opening to how you know, we could say this is just a story, but to me it seems to accord most accurately with my actual experience. Is, well, what about the body that's like not just sensations, that's not just my experience? Well, what would that be? All I have is my experience, and it's mostly these physical sensations, and opening to them as almost like there's this boundless awareness that I've been calling now and here. So the body, as we experience it, is like this texture of now and here. It's nice thing about the body is, like, it's never, we never have an experience of the body at some other time and place. It's almost like the now and here is this bodily experience. Of course, and thoughts and feelings or emotions. But I think a dominant kind of flavor or texture is maybe better, because it's talking about physical. The texture of here and now is this contraction and relaxation. almost seems to fill the whole space of here and now. Like some, if I'm walking along and I'm feeling tension in the body, it doesn't feel like it's just like some limited to some little area of the of this bag of skin. It feels like the sensation is pervading the whole space of here and now. I don't know if you ever feel it that way. Mm-hmm. And then I'm walking along and I'm looking at the trees, and they're part of this, the ocean of here and now, the ocean of now, right? And they're not a different ocean. You could say the texture of the ocean is physical tension filling the whole space. And the color of the now is the color of the trees. So almost like the trees are part of the bodily tension. And the bodily tension is part of seeing the trees. It's all one piece called here and now. And almost like the colors fill the whole space of here and now. Don't they? I mean, like right now, the colors are filling the space of present awareness. And the sounds are filling the space. And the bodily sensations feel like they're also filling the space of now. All like together, miraculously. And all of it is, you could say, is one unchanging now. But the texture is constantly changing of bodily sensations, and the colors are constantly changing, and the sounds are constantly changing. But the space, or the ocean, isn't. Do you have some sense like that? It's a different way of, like, the body, so the body is kind of mingling with the color of the trees. The sensations of the body, right? The sensations of the body are the texture of the sound of these words. Strangely. It's all one ocean. So, anyway, about this mind transforming into body, I was thinking, you hear this kind of thing in Zen and elsewhere, but I was wondering, what's the scriptural reference for this kind of thing? Did they ever actually really explicitly say that in India? I wondered when I heard that Shohaku Okamura said, that's an unusual thing. I thought, yeah, where do they teach that? And I think one place it's taught is in the realm of Buddhas, like we were just saying. The Dharmakaya, formless reality body, manifests a transformation body called Nirmanakaya. But that's like in the Buddha realm. Buddhas are manifestation bodies. What about our bodies? So I just happened to be reading this book because some of us are studying Vasubandhu's 30 verses over breakfast these days. And over oatmeal that... Yes. When we can experience it as the... moving down the throat is a bodily experience. And then we can also experience breakfast kind of in the belly. I do notice that on stewed fruit mornings, my belly has a different feeling after breakfast. Yeah? I wouldn't say exactly uncomfortable, but it's like more noticeable than other breakfasts. that's an experience that, if we look really deeply, the experience of this sensation in the belly is like, it's just this knowing of this kind of texture of nowness called post-stewed fruit belly. Anyway, we were talking about the storehouse consciousness. So this is Xuanzang, who translated our version of the Heart Sutra, one of the great translators of all time, who 7th or 8th century, somewhere in there, maybe earlier, maybe 6th, went from China to India and studied with all these Indian teachers, and this is his commentary on Vasubandhu. He says, the body with its organs, due to the power of maturation of seeds in the storehouse consciousness, body with organs means because of the power of the maturation of seeds in the storehouse consciousness, this consciousness evolves and transforms into the material organs and the place that supports the organs, which we call the body. So I thought, wow, there it is, really, really directly. This is a little paragraph in a somewhat obscure text, but there's probably other places, but I happened to read this the week before Sashin. Body with its organs means that because of the power of these maturing karmic seeds in the storehouse consciousness, this is the model here, is that our storehouse consciousness is the collection of all our karmic tendencies. Where seeds have been planted, and these seeds come to fruition. The seeds in the storehouse consciousness mature or come to fruition, and the consciousness evolves into the material organs and the body that supports the organs. In other words, the great elements of earth, water, fire, and air, and their derivatives. And interestingly, he says, this is because of the, this is a conversation about individual seeds and seeds held in common as part of this version of it. This is story, right? About the storehouse consciousness, that there's some karmic seeds that are collective, as, for example, the whole human species shares certain kinds of seeds, and then each individual human has particular karmic seeds from the experiences that they have had. But even if we've had vastly different experiences, we have almost like identical types of seeds, just as the human species. It's part of the intricacy of this model. And the body and the material organs of the body evolve from the particular seeds, which you could say that's why we have particular different types of bodies and different sicknesses and so on. And because of the power of the maturing of the commonly held seeds, consciousness evolves into the apparent existence of other beings and the physical world at large. So, without getting too much into it, you could say that's why we see like a similar, we all look around the Zendo and it's almost the same for all of us. We can agree on all these things because these are common seeds that we share. That create almost the same Zendo for each of us in each of our minds. What's that? Yeah, in some ways, I think you can make lots of parallels between this storehouse consciousness model and genetics. Yeah, in some ways. The only, I would say, yeah, I think as metaphors too, they work very nicely together. And maybe the main difference would be the usual genomes or genetic model is coming from the paradigm of materialism. So they're physical structures, whereas these seeds are non-physical seeds because your mind and intentions and karma and so on is like the primary emphasis in the Buddha Dharma. But yeah, similar. It's almost like mind genetics. So, Keizan says, body arises in the mind, and when the body arises, they appear to be distinguished. I think this is part of the interesting thing too, because the way we've been talking, we see how body is not distinguished from mind. Body and mind are totally inseparable in this model, right? Body is, in a way, pervading the mind space called now, and the mind space called now is pervading the body in a way too. They're totally inseparable. But when the body arises, don't we feel like this is the body, it's not the mind? And this is part of where the trouble begins. Here's Keizan's description of the trouble. When the body arises, they appear to be distinguished. When one wave arises, or one wave moves, 10,000 waves follow. The moment a single mental fabrication arises, numberless things appear. So the four elements, earth, water, fire, air, and the five aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, formations, consciousness, join together. Four limbs, arms and legs, and five senses appear, and on until the 36 body parts and the 12-fold chain of interdependent arising. I think Patrick's taken his class in the, was it 32 or 30? 36 parts of the body. So maybe there's other versions where they add four in. Do you know them off?
Head, hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, sinews, flesh, bones, marrow. It ends with urine and oil of the joints. Feces is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The brain is one of them.
Heart, lungs.
Diaphragm.
Spleen, liver. It's funny that brain's not one of them, huh? They must have done autopsies in ancient India, even in Buddha's time.
I think it's really the appealing part of Buddhism, or at least Zen Buddhism to me, is that we have body and mind in a relationship. And other religions say, well, all you have to do is change your mind, which means you believe something or you accept some kind of doctrine. But I think our practice is special because we don't have to rely on that. We can command our body. Body may not like it, but we'll do what we ask it to do.
Well, I don't know about that. Sometimes. It's definitely about the body and mind as one piece, inseparable. And this story was one way of talking about body and mind, not too the non-duality of body and mind. But it's true, as Ziggy was saying, that in that model, you could say mind is a little bit more primary, because we don't say that mind is being experienced by the body in our actual experience, I think. But we can say the body is being experienced by the mind.
Especially during session, body experiences all this pain. And I wonder how much of that pain is actually due to what the mind is up to.
Well, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't feel it otherwise, right?
It does, I think, you know,
yeah.
The interrelation is dynamic.
And I think it's interesting to even our language, like, it's nice to look experientially when we feel like the body is experiencing pain, to really look at how we would express it most accurately. And I would say it's not really that the body is experiencing pain, right? It's like the painful body is an experience.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And you could say the experiencing, or we could call it mind, or we could call it the ocean of now, but it's an experience of pain, and then we call that the painful body. We almost, like, body is just a, I guess, is a way we could sit, we could express a certain kind of pain that's not emotional pain, for example. It's a bodily, physical pain. But again, what is body pain? It's just, seems like it's just like contraction or relaxation. Maybe there's other things in between too, but I almost feel like every bodily experience can be put into those.
I listened to way too much public radio, and I just heard this really interesting news story about how actually taking Tylenol, especially around the time that you're experiencing some kind of emotional trauma, say Christmas dinner with the folks, if you take the Tylenol, the pain actually, that the psychic pain, the mental pain, the emotional pain, is the very same basis as experiencing physical pain, which is why the Tylenol works on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you smash your thumb with a hammer and you take a Tylenol, it's not perfect, but it's better. And you sit down, you know, with the folks and they start nattering on about how you've wasted your life and size of it. You know, you pop a Tylenol and you smile along and pass the trip.
Well, I wonder if it's, I mean, I don't know how this research, but I wonder if it could be because usually painful emotion, as I mentioned the other day, I think is always this combination of bodily, physical sensation and conceptual story. So maybe like we're getting criticized by our family for wasting our life in Zazen. And that creates, of course, the emotional thing, but the body is also tight too. So maybe it's if we have the Tylenol, the body relaxes, and therefore it gets a little disconnected from the story, and therefore then the story relaxes.
Well, this is
so Kokyo's random theory. Yeah.
Consensus way.
Yeah.
This is just, you know, it was on the radio and I'm sitting there.
Mind-body connection.
Between, you know, votes of Donald Trump and, you know.
It's
speaking of mind.
Much research in this mind-body realm continues. It's amazing what people are doing now. It's with meditators too, right? Hooking up the meditators. Yes, of course.
Hooks up monks with, mm-hmm. Yeah, and also with MRIs, or what do you call it? For the brain MRIs, called something. PET scan?
Once fabrication arises, it develops continuity, but it still only exists through the combining and piling up of myriad phenomena. The mind is like the ocean waters, the body like the waves. There are no waves without water, and no water without waves. Water and waves are not separate. Motion and stillness are not different. So this is a nice description of mind and body inseparable. But again, we're kind of saying mind is like the ocean, and the bodies, we could say the body as the sensations are the waves arising and ceasing on the ocean of experience in. Mind here does not mean mind in this discussion is not like just our thinking mind, right? It's like the ocean of experiencing. The ocean of now is nothing but the experiencing. Who is experiencing this? We have no idea. What is this experiencing? It has no name. We can't really grasp it. but it's undeniable. We are experiencing, that is for sure. And so seeing we really, that's what we maybe start noticing more and more. All kinds of stuff is happening, but all of this is happening in the ocean of experiencing, which is ungraspable and boundless.
It reminds me of something Freud said about the conscious mind being like the surface of the ocean. And the unconscious mind is everything in the world.
Yes, yeah. So Shohaku Okamura, regarding this, says, Zazen is like sitting on the bottom of the ocean while our head is still up on the surface where the waves are going on. Shohaku Okamura Roshi. Okamura. So almost like there's some realm that's very still at the bottom of the ocean, but there still might be thinking going on.
Oh, yeah. Making Christmas
list. The Christmas list is making waves on the surface. But Zazen is what's happening down below. The deep depths.
A line in one of my poems about the stone at the bottom of the cold stream makes no comment about what is going by.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
So Zazen's like the cold stone at the bottom. Exactly. It makes no comment. Even though it's fine if there's waves, if there's a big storm up there, it's fine for the one sitting Zazen at the bottom, even if their hair starts getting all like sloshed around by the waves out of the top. It's kind of like, that's okay because my hara is like unmoving down at the bottom. So it is said by ancestor Baijiang, the true person comes and goes, lives and dies as the indestructible, imperishable body of four elements and five aggregates. I thought, wow, this is a cool quote. You have to hear this again. Because usually we talk about the true person of no position, right, is like that which doesn't, like the Dharmakaya, that's just the unchanging experiencing. And the illusory person is the constantly changing birth and death, five skandhas and four elements. So this is a non-dual expression, bringing them together. Baijiang says, the true person actually comes and goes, lives and dies, as the indestructible, imperishable, unchanging body of four elements and five aggregates. So I thought, it's four elements and five aggregates are what's constantly changing and being destroyed, impermanent. But he says, the indestructible body of this constantly changing stuff.
Right?
And it's like, I think the ocean and waves works nicely. It's the indestructible, unchanging ocean that's constantly changing as the body comes and goes, and bodies come and go, and waves arise and cease, and birth and death arise and cease, and the five skandhas arise and cease, and the four elements arise and cease. All of that is the indestructible true body, the unchanging true body. Yeah, the constantly changing as a whole totality is completely unchanging. The suffering and discontent that's arising and ceasing is the totally free, content reality. So, Kazan's bringing it all together there. Zazen is going right into the ocean of Buddha nature, manifesting the essence of all Buddhas. The natural luminosity of mind suddenly reveals itself and the one original light shines everywhere. There is no increase or decrease in the ocean, and the waves never turn back or stop. There's no increase or decrease in the ocean, but the waves flow on incessantly. Hopefully this is like, you know, pertinent teaching to our actual zazen, because we pay attention to all the stuff that's coming and going, don't we? Because that's what's interesting, because it's new every moment. It's fresh. It's like, and it's captivating and it's disturbing. So those waves will flow on incessantly, no problem. But at the same time, which is the time called now, the ocean of the totality of experiencing is never moves a particle.
We vow to
take our seat at the bottom of the ocean. Don't worry, be happy. May all beings receive the positive energy of our wholesome intentions and open to the realm of no worry, be happy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.